Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Day one of the second Trump administration is just 14 days away. Donald Trump made many campaign promises about what he would accomplish on day one, and one of the promises he made continually was the beginning of what he called the largest deportation in American history. There are those who question whether something on that scale is even possible. They also fear the impact accomplishing such a feat may have on the U.S. economy. But fears over this promise are no doubt greater in the immigrant community, because not only does Trump want to launch major deportations and appears willing to temporarily house people in camps as they wait to be processed, he has also expressed a desire to eliminate temporary protective status, which allows people living in unsafe conditions in foreign countries to stay here in the United States. Many people with this status have been living here legally for decades. Advocates and legal experts are working to educate the immigrant community about their rights and about what we might expect in the months to come. And we look at that right now with Stefania Arteaga. She's the co-director of the Carolina Migrant Network. Jamila Espinosa is a Charlotte immigration attorney with Espinosa Law. And Julian Berger is WFAE's race and equity reporter. Welcome to you all. Thank you for being here.
Good morning.
Good morning. As I said, Donald Trump promised to do a lot of things on day one of his second administration, among them pardoning the January 6th rioters, banning trans athletes from sports, and firing special counsel Jack Smith, although he has short-circuited that promise by resigning ahead of time. But of all Trump's promises, that of mass deportations is likely to have the greatest impact. There are questions about how that could even be accomplished, but there is little doubt that he will try. Stefania, how seriously is the immigrant community taking this promise? What are they expressing as their major concerns?
Thank you, Mike. Well, you know, I think a lot of us still remember Trump 1.0 and the fear that communities felt as we were seeing ICE enforcement in immigrant communities, particularly on the east side of Charlotte. Folks remember what it was like driving down Central Avenue and seeing ICE agents stopping vehicles going into apartment complexes. For many folks who remember those years, this is very real and traumatic, having to prepare for a Trump 2.0 administration where we have same players in place that are going to continue this very draconian policies to target immigrant community members.
You know, you said people remember those raids on apartment complexes and sometimes businesses, but I'm not sure that's necessarily true. People in the immigrant community certainly remember it, but I'll bet you the people at population at large was fairly well shielded from that. If you can, if you know from firsthand experience what that was like, what was it like?
Oh, goodness, Mike. Well, yeah, certainly from firsthand experience, I can tell you, you know, going down Central Avenue into apartment complexes, we would receive phone calls to our organization saying that there were vehicles stopping individuals. Our organization would send volunteers and document those apprehensions. And often we would saw where agents in civilian clothing, in unmarked vehicles, questioning folks about their immigration status. And folks were just concerned, confused about what were these individuals who just looked like regular people asking them about their immigration status, often claiming to be looking for some people, but actually just trying to get whoever was around. Hmm. They were certainly very troubling times. I remember vividly, you know, seeing ICE vans behind the CVS on Kilbourne and Central Avenue, where ICE were putting people in those vans as they were gathering them. It was truly a nightmare situation.
Jamila, you're the lawyer here. Constitutionally, legally, are there laws in place that might act as a kind of roadblock to immediate deportation? Or since he's promised to be dictator, but only on day one, and those are his words, is Trump likely to run roughshod over any legal protections?
So that's part of what we're trying to do in the community and working with organizations like Stefania's is empowering the community about those rights and informing them that there are constitutional protections, that the president just can't come in from day one. I think that's a misconception, not just for those that are American citizens, but within the migrant community, that Trump comes in and all rights go out the window. No, they still have constitutional rights. You still have due process. Even if ICE was to detain you, you have the ability to see an immigration judge if you do not have a removal order. And that's what we do believe that Trump and, as Estefania mentioned, the same players are going to be in place. So Tom Homan is very well versed in how the laws function. And so although Trump says, you know, all rights are out the window, Tom Homan knows what kind of rights immigrants have. And that's why among those that are going to be at the forefront for deportation are those that have removal orders. Those are those that are.
And you believe, and you believe that Donald Trump, as president, will follow those laws, or if he says he'll be dictator on day one, and day one is when he promised to deport, begin these mass deportations. Will he follow the law, or will he simply do something and ask for permission later, which puts these people in a bind?
I don't have confidence that the president would follow the law, but I think those that he has put in place have become very well versed in the law. Mm-hmm. So someone like Tom Homan, who has served under President Obama, served under the President Trump, he's going to ensure that he does be able, that he will be able to effectuate these policies that we are able to do, at least initially this mass deportation, which is also what we are expecting. You know, so there is part of what we the rhetoric with Trump is that there's going to be mass deportation, but are there the resources? So what we believe is probably going to be an initial shock and awe. Those people that have removal orders, those individuals that, as Estefania mentioned, they would come and detain individuals. What President Trump likes to see is the imagery. He wants those images of people being detained, placed in vans. What the public won't know as a whole is those individuals still will have rights. They likely may be able to eventually be released on bond. Those that have removal orders will be deported. And those are those images that I believe the president will want you to see. But in the long run, will it be sustainable without Congress providing the resources? I don't believe that mass deportation will be sustainable in the long run.
Julian Berger is with us. He's WFAE's race and equity reporter. And Julian, you recently attended a meeting held by the Carolina Migrant Network to prepare for these deportations. How worried were the people who were there attending that meeting about the prospect of what was about to happen? And were they worried for themselves or for members of their family or both? Julian, I think you're muted. Well, for some reason, we're not getting your audio, so I'll ask that question to Stefania because it was your organization's meeting.
Thank you, Mike. Well, we saw a range of emotions, folks who were very concerned about their own individual situations and folks who were there because they wanted to provide help. We know that what we're seeing once again is community coming together and figuring out how can they be equipped with the information that they need, but also take action. And that's what we're really trying to encourage people to do. Just before the holidays, we sent out a group of volunteers, of individuals who were coming to our community meetings, to canvas the main veins of Charlotte, where we see the largest groups of immigrant community members, to share information. We have flyers that share very basic information about people's individual constitutional rights. And we've also been strongly promoting these Know Your Rights sessions that we are putting together with multiple organizations across the city to really encourage people to educate themselves, but also be spokespeople of these rights, right? We know that simply keeping this information to ourselves is not helpful, but sharing it with others certainly is. And so we're really focused on ensuring that people can come, get informed, take action, so we can prepare. Because at the end of the day, we are dealing with the federal government, right? And we need to make sure that people understand that there are ways to advocate for yourself to ensure that your rights are not violated.
Julian, I'm going to try this again. According to Time Magazine, the United States is already deporting people at the highest rate in a decade. We deported more than 271,000 immigrants in the last fiscal year of the Biden administration. Has anyone you've spoken with talked about the impact of that? Okay, I'm going to ask you to disconnect and reconnect, Julian, because we're not getting your audio at all. Jamila, do we know about the impact of what's happened so far in the last year of the Biden administration?
We have. You know, recently, right before Christmas here in the Charlotte area, a colleague mentioned to several of us that she had an individual, a little boy and a father who were deported within 32 hours from the city of Charlotte back to Honduras. They were to report to the local ICE office under the pretext that they were going to come talk to the ICE officials about their case. The child, so they had been ordered removed. Their case had been heard. Looks like they did not have counsel at that point when they had their case heard. The child had pending relief. So there was relief for the child pending with immigration. The father and child went without an attorney to immigration and never came home. Within 32 hours, they were already back in Honduras. So we have already seen this during especially an escalation within the last couple of months that the deportations, those that have removal orders, they are effectuating those deportations much quicker.
The meeting that I referred to held by the Carolina Migrant Network a moment ago was held just after the election in November, just after Donald Trump won. And Julian reported in his story about that, Stefania, that only about 50 people showed up to that meeting. If there is a fear in the community about impending deportations or what the Trump administration might or might not do, why did so few people attend?
Well, Mike, I think first of all, it was the shock effect. I think people were still grieving what that meant. But then we kept on having events after that. We actually had an event on December 5th where we had over 130 people show up who wanted to know what their rights were. And we had people sign up to go ahead and share these Know Your Rights trainings in their neighborhoods. I think initially it was just really people just trying to figure out what was going to go on with their lives. I know I grieved a lot with my family, talking about what we were going to do as a family unit if anything happened to one of us. But ultimately, you know, I think folks have had the opportunity to spend time with their loved ones, to think through more deeply about what's going to happen the next 4 years and prepare to take action. And prepare to not only go to these events, but also participate in family preparedness trainings and where we talk to individuals about the type of documentation you need to prepare in case there is a situation like the one Jamila mentioned, where a family member is detained, ensuring that if you have a U.S. citizen child, that they have dual citizenship in case you are returned to your home country. And so that is exactly what we're trying to do.
Jamila.
No, I think with the election, there was also a lot of confusion. Why was there so much support within the Latino community when there was immigration was such a big topic? And I think we've also seen that also within the migrant community, and that there wasn't necessarily a mass deportation initially in that first Trump administration. And so we have seen discussions within the migrant community that it may just be rhetoric for him to have been elected, and that may not actually occur. And so it's almost been also a wait and see. Maybe things that he said during the campaign was just rhetoric and it actually may not take effect. And I think that has also played into a factor on people not coming out, as well as fear, as Stefania mentioned.
So this could be we're going to build a wall and Mexico is going to pay for it moment?
Yes.
Julian, I want you to say hello to me, Julian, before we go to the
Hi,
there
you
we
hear
go.
Me now?
Good.
Yes.
There we get your audio. So when we come back, we'll hear from you as well. Julian Berger is with us from WFAE News. Jamila Espinosa, immigration attorney with Espinosa Law, and Stefania Arteaga, co-director of the Carolina Migrant Network. We will continue our conversation moments from now. Stay with us at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the prospect of mass deportations promised constantly for day one by Donald Trump during the campaign. We're just 14 days away from day one. And Jamila Espinosa is with us. She's an immigration attorney with Espinosa Law. Julian Berger, who is also with us from WFAE News, Jamila, reported that at these meetings that have been going on among the immigrant community, they wanted answers on how to protect their family members from deportation. Given what you know about the incoming Trump administration's plans, and we don't know a lot, and we don't know definitively what's going to happen until it does, what is the most effective way, if there is one, to protect these people? Jamila.
So among the ways that we are helping to protect them and inform them is, one, ensuring that they know their rights. So it seems very basic, but many times, as Estefania explained, when there have been raids, many of the ICE officials don't know who they're looking for. They don't know an individual's immigration status by just looking at them. They don't have the judicial orders required under the law to actually detain a person. And so they will go to apartment complexes and profile individuals. And among those rights is constitutional rights that everyone has, the right to remain silent. And so educating them on those fundamental rights are one of the first things to protect them. Having powers of attorneys. We have already seen in the community, some of the biggest fears is, I'm a homeowner. I've lived in the United States for a really long time. If temporary protective status is not granted to me, I lose my employment authorization or I'm deported, do I keep my home? Or what happens with that? So ensuring they have powers of attorneys that ensure that their bank accounts, their homes, they are able to have someone that they trust, have authority over those types of assets are some of the ways that we're ensuring that they can be protected.
Go ahead, I'm sorry. No, go ahead.
A big issue that we've seen come up is the birthright issue, right? If you have a U.S. citizen child and you are undocumented, should my child have a passport? And so we're not trying to fearmonger. That is something that we've talked about. Would Trump come in and try to take birthright citizenship? That's absolutely something that we think under the Constitution, yes, it's not going to be possible. But he could come in, try to do an executive order. It would have to make its way up through the courts. And so that is something that we have encouraged undocumented parents that have U.S. citizen children, go and get them U.S. passports. Those are the tidbits that we are sharing in those Know Your Rights.
Julian, during your brief departure from us as you were reconnecting, we talked about the 50 people who came to that first meeting that was held by the Carolina Migrant Network back in November, and how later on in December, more people attended that meeting. I'm assuming that that's because reality had begun to set in. From your conversations with people in the community that you have covered and reported on, are their concerns increasing? Do they feel less insecure now because of being informed about their legal rights? So what is the general feeling?
Yeah, I think once the election happened back in November, there was just a general concern in the immigrant community. There were a lot of people who were like, what's going to happen to my DACA? What's going to happen to my TPS? What's going to happen to the visa that I'm currently on? So we saw a lot of fear. Because in the last administration, a lot of these programs were rescinded and then went through the courts, and they were just all in limbo. Nobody knew what was going on with DACA, with TPS. So I think this time around, it was the same concern. And when I would go to those Know Your Rights workshops, the one that happened in December with Carolina Migrant Network, they were just looking for answers. There were so many questions. The event lasted over 2 hours because everybody just had concerns of for themselves, for their family members, for their friends. They just wanted to make sure that they can protect themselves as well as everybody else around them.
Stefania, this is radio. So a moment ago, you held up some pieces of paper that you are handing out at these meetings to various people. And unless you're watching us on Facebook, nobody saw that. But I want to ask what's on those papers. I think what's on those papers is the rights that people have that they should be aware of. What exactly are their rights?
Well, we're currently focusing on ensuring people know at least just the basic information. Like Jamila mentioning, ensuring people know that they have the right to be quiet. They have the right to not open their door if an ICE agent is outside unless they have a judicial warrant signed by a judge. They have the right to document what happens. North Carolina is a one-party consent state for recording. We know that if there is a detention and of a violation occurs and that is documented, that is great, a great tool to have for an attorney, and really encouraging folks to have a plan. We're also giving out these red cards. On one side, it tells them what their constitutional rights are, and on the other, it is a statement for an official, whether it's law enforcement, local law enforcement, or ICE, that lets that official know that that person is going to use their Fifth Amendment right, not to sign or answer any questions, not to get permission to enter your home, and request an attorney. So this is a type of information we want folks to carry on them in the event that you are stopped and you don't know what to say. You can simply pull out this card, hand it over to the official, and just be quiet. Being quiet is your best friend in these situations. And if there's something we've learned after Trump 1.0, especially after a lot of the work that we did, was the power of just informing folks about the right of not opening a door. A lot of the detentions that were prevented were because folks knew that if they opened the door, ICE could just go in, right? Not even having verbal consent, and oftentimes did. And ensuring people knew that they should keep their door closed. If there were ICE agents outside, ask for a judicial warrant that they could see through a window, or whether it was slid through a door, was the best way to keep their families safe.
Is there a language obstacle here? Do the ICE agents who approach these people at the door, do they speak Spanish?
I would say it varies, really. But I think either way, regardless, it's important that folks verbalize it, whether it's in English or Spanish or whichever other language they may speak, that they say, "You don't have consent to enter my home. You don't have consent if they've entered. You don't have consent to search my home or my vehicle." You know, we've seen situations in where one of the cases we have here at the Carolina Migrant Network was a case of a mother who was breastfeeding her child. And ICE actually broke the glass door and entered through it and detained her as she was breastfeeding her child. We have seen situations that have escalated to such a degree. And so even though that the situations may occur occasionally, we want to make sure people know that they can still say specific language that can protect them.
There are literally millions of undocumented immigrants living in the United States right now. Some have been here for years, and according to Julian's reporting, about 58,000 undocumented immigrants live in Mecklenburg County alone, with 325,000 in North Carolina at large. Jamila, from what you know, would all of these people be candidates for deportation under Trump's plans?
Under Trump's plan, yes. I mean, his plan is to deport anyone that is considered undocumented. Anyone that has no legal status in the United States, he plans to deport. Now, whether that will include, and those numbers could increase if he hasn't been clear whether he's going to include DACA, if he rescinds DACA or temporary protective status, or those that arrived within the last couple of years under the Biden administration with humanitarian parole. And those individuals that have come from four specific countries. So the numbers could be much larger than what we're actually seeing. If Trump decided to also include those individuals.
Deporting millions of people would be a Herculean task. I don't know how it can be accomplished, but maybe it can be. But if successful, just talk about North Carolina, Stefania. We're talking about 325,000 people here. What would the impact of their removal from the country be, either on the community at large, on housing, on business, on the economy?
Well, you know, New American Economy a couple of years ago did a fantastic report looking at the economic contributions of immigrants in our community. And just alone in the Charlotte-Mecklenburg area, we're seeing about $2.7 billion in tax dollars that are being paid to our community and $7.4 billion in spending power. We're talking about individuals that are contributing to the growth of our community, that are certainly investing back into it. And then when we look at the overall demographics, particularly in the Latino community, what we see is that the largest chunk of the Latino community are US-born individuals, right? The percentage of individuals that are foreign-born and likely to be undocumented is smaller in our parents in this degree, right? So we're seeing a situation in where folks are contributing significantly, but are also raising families and contributing to this the diversity of our state. And certainly could have significant economic impacts if we are seeing detentions of individuals who are largely represented in our agricultural sector. Certainly in Mecklenburg County, we surpassed the national average for the number of undocumented construction workers. We have large chicken processing centers across the state as well that heavily depend on migrant labor.
I don't know which one of you can answer this question, if any of you can, but the Social Security is facing a problem because there's simply not enough money coming in to pay out what they have to pay out every month, and it's going to get worse as the baby boomers continue to retire at about 10 or 20,000 people per day over the course of time. A lot of these undocumented immigrants hold jobs on which they pay FICA taxes, which are the taxes that fund Social Security. But because they don't have Social Security cards, they do not get the benefits of Social Security down the line. If you take them out of the equation, how quickly does Social Security face a major problem?
Well, I couldn't tell you how quickly, but what I can tell you is that it's significant. And second of all, we have a population that is not growing at the speed that we need it. And so immigrant labor and migration is critical to the health of the US economy to be able to sustain those social safety nets, but also the various industries that exist. Yes, to your point, right? We are not only seeing a humanitarian crisis if we're seeing mass deportation, but a significant economic impact across the country. If we are seeing people who are being removed, and even if we, see Trump just make a show in the first 100 days, there's still the fear factor, right? Folks being scared that they should not stay in the US and should look to migrate elsewhere as well.
There is a process for deportation before a person can be deported under U.S. law. It requires that they have a final order of removal issued by an immigration court, which have been underfunded. These courts have been underfunded and understaffed for years. They're not part of the court system. They're part of the Department of Justice. And they currently have 3.6 million cases pending before various immigration judges. Does this make mass deportations, Jamila, a pipe dream?
Yes, the reality is absolutely. We see it here in Charlotte. People that may be recently arrived to the United States are getting hearing dates still in 2027. Their first hearing date is in 2027. That's the first time that they're going to appear before an immigration judge for a preliminary hearing. That is not their final hearing before the judge. It is something that the courts have been contending with because Congress has continued to underfund immigration. And that's why it is honestly unrealistic to believe that mass deportation can occur.
Well,
And
correct me if I'm wrong, because right now, if you fall under that category of having to face a deportation court for a decision, you are set free to live your life until your case comes back to the court and they make a decision on your status. But he's promising, Donald Trump is promising, mass deportations and putting people in camps, housing them in camps while they await these decisions, if these decisions come. Would that be legal under the law? Can we do that?
So under the law, they still have the ability to seek bond before an immigration judge. The judge still had the judge still has to look at the law and their standards that are set. There still have to be a risk to national security. There's still standards that have to be met under the law that a judge would have to review and determine that this
But we
person is
put we put
eligible.
people in we put people in camps before in separated families. I'm assuming that something along the same lines will be taking place because Tom Homan, who's in charge of all this, has said so. Is it legal? Is there recourse? Once you're in those camps, can an attorney get you out?
So we've seen it, under the MPP, the Migrant Protocol, when they decided to institute the Migrant Protocol they instituted camps in Mexico, in which it was very hard. It was nearly impossible to get representation. They have said that they want to institute the Alien Enemies Act, which has only been invoked during times of war. Actually, I think believe three times total during a war of 1812, World War I, and World War II. Those that were foreign from specific, very specific countries. And we've seen what has happened when we have done internment camps, specifically during the Japanese, which is really a shameful part of American history. Congress, presidents, courts have had to apologize for what we did to the Japanese during those times. If that's, what the president chooses to do, then that's going to be a very sad time. I do not believe that under the law, because of the way the courts have treated the Alien Enemies Act previously, the president would be able to do so. What we have seen from the Trump administration is that he certainly will try, and it's going to be up to the courts to have to challenge him, and attorneys to really have to fight it out and defend migrants.
Julian, calling these people alien enemies makes them sound very dangerous, and maybe some of them are, I don't know. But during the campaign and at other times, Donald Trump has often characterized undocumented immigrants as crazed killers and rapists, criminals, in other words. I suppose it could be argued that if you are here and did not come through channels, that you have broken the law and that makes you a criminal. But outside of that, are most of the 325,000 undocumented immigrants in North Carolina living law-abiding lives?
Yeah, they are. A lot of them, they have families. A lot of them are working. 69% of immigrants that are in North Carolina are working. They're contributing to the economy. A lot of them speak English. So they are not committing crimes like President-elect Trump is saying. The majority of them, most of them are law-abiding people in this country.
Yesterday on NBC's Meet the Press, Senate Majority Leader John Thune, the Republican from South Dakota, cast doubt on Trump's plans to deport 3 million undocumented immigrants. He said that Trump has to be realistic about what the government can do and that the incoming administration needed to pace itself. Is he throwing cold water, Stefania, on Trump's plans or merely elucidating the difficulty that those plans would face?
The reality is that it's going to be extremely difficult to be able to execute his plans. What we're likely to see is pressure from the federal government on states to also partake in immigration enforcement. That is something that we've been seeing, particularly out of Florida and Texas, who are really laying the groundwork on what it means to change state laws to also include immigration enforcement. And it's going to bring constitutional challenges.
Texas Republican Senator John Cornyn has also chimed in on these plans. He's a Republican. I want to talk about what he had to say, and then I want to come back and talk about who these people are that we're talking about in broad general terms. Who are these undocumented immigrants? What do they do? Why are they here? And more when we come back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. We're talking about the prospect of mass deportations that the incoming Trump administration has promised. Stefania Arteaga is with us. She's co-director of the Carolina Migrant Network. Julian Berger is our race and equity reporter at WFAE News. And Jamila Espinosa is an immigration attorney with Espinosa Law. Jamila, Texas Republican Senator John Cornyn says that, quote, "We need to focus on the criminals, the people affiliated with terrorist organizations." To me, he says, that should be our priority when it comes to these deportations. But how do you control illegal immigration if you don't take action against those who made it into the country illegally, even if they have become law-abiding, productive citizens once they've arrived here and could be considered contributors to the community? How do you control future illegal crossings, etc., if you don't do this?
I think that's it's a fine line. I think that they have to, deal with those that they've already had here for decades, You have those that have temporary protective status, those that have DACA. There has to be some type of pathway for those while also securing our border. There has to be a method in which, yes, there has to be means in which, as any sovereign country, has to be secure. But as the governor explains, the focus, as was, Obama received a lot of criticism. One of, those that work in the immigration space often called him deporter in chief. He has some of the most record high deportations because the focus was those that had committed or had been arrested, not even gone through the whole due process, had just been arrested or alleged to have been committed a crime. They focused their resource. ICE was very effective under the Obama administration because they focused their resources in the jails and being able to, once someone had been arrested for a crime, immediately let them see a judge while they were detained. And if they did not get any relief while in the United States, once they saw the judge, they were deported immediately to their home country. And that's why that system worked. And he had the record deportations that he did.
Tom Homan is the so-called border czar under the new incoming Trump administration. He's the man who will be spearheading deportation efforts, and he has said the operation will first target those seen as public safety and national security threats, but that anyone in the country without authorization should not feel comfortable. Those are his words. Given the vast number of people who have crossed the border without going through channels and then simply disappeared into the fabric of the nation, is there any way to really target those who are public safety or national security threats? And if there is a way to do that, wouldn't we already have done that?
I believe, in my assessment from the previous administrations in which Tom Homan has worked in, is how he has targeted has been those that have been arrested. Those that are out there and may pose a national security risk that they yet are to know of, that the FBI or the CIA, they are not on anybody's radar. I do not believe that those are the individuals that they can just magically now be on their radar. I believe that what his focus will once again be is working with the sheriffs. That's why his rhetoric has been very directed at states and cities that have said they are going to be sanctuary cities, is because he wants that cooperation, in particular with sheriffs and jails, because of the limited resources that are allocated to ICE. He wants his ICE agents to be able to easily pick up individuals from ICE. And I believe it was Julian who had a recent report that even here, though, in Mecklenburg County, we've already had, I think initially there was 19 detentions, and Julian could give you the statistics on the most recent numbers on that, but ICE has yet to pick up those detainers, even in Mecklenburg County.
Julian?
So there's already a disconnect in between what ICE says they're going to do and then what they're actually doing.
Yeah, Julian, the sheriffs around around the state have been told by the General Assembly that you must cooperate with ICE, something that our sheriff in Mecklenburg County, Gary McFadden, has not been doing heretofore because he doesn't think he has the legal authority to do it, but now he has to do it. And he's reported these folks that he's arrested if their immigration status is questionable to ICE, and ICE has done nothing about it. Talk about that.
Yeah, so I reached out to the Mecklenburg County Sheriff's Office last week to see the number of detainers that they've received from ICE. So the detainer basically means that they have to notify ICE if they're going to release a non-citizen back into the city, into the county. So in the month of December, Mecklenburg County Sheriff's Office, they received 38 detainers from ICE, but they said that none of those people that had received the detainer were picked up by ICE. And there's a little bit of finger pointing between both entities, the Sheriff's Office and ICE. The Mecklenburg County Sheriff's Office is saying nobody from ICE has contacted them, nobody from ICE has arranged those pickups, and ICE is saying that they have no record that the jail and the Sheriff's Office have told ICE that those individuals were scheduled to be released back into the county. So there's a little bit of confusion. Who is telling the truth? Who is really responsible for these people not being picked up by ICE?
The politics in America is often a politics of fear and loathing, and that is how these undocumented individuals have been portrayed, at least by Donald Trump during his many campaigns. for president, as I said, rapists and deranged killers, people who have escaped from insane asylums, etc. None of which is true, by the way. I mean, there are going to be some criminals in the bunch because they're criminals amongst all of us. But none of that is true at large part. And New York Democratic Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez says these people serve as the backbone of our local economies and communities. Who are these people, Stefania? For people who don't interface with these folks, who cannot identify an undocumented individual from somebody who is a U.S. citizen, who are they? Why are they here? What jobs are they filling? What role are they playing?
Mike, these folks are folks just like you and me, folks that are trying to make ends meet and provide for their families. When we really look at the data and who are these folks, we're talking about folks in the construction industry. We can even look back historically at the migration of particularly Mexican nationals from Texas as a result in the 80s due to the growth in the city. We see an overwhelming representation of Salvadoran nationals, for example, in the painting industry here in Charlotte, in the hospitality industry. These are folks who are just trying to provide for their families and provide what they couldn't back home in the safety of a country that has protections that they weren't otherwise able to obtain. I think about the clients that we represent here at the Carolina Migrant Network, and these are folks who are often fleeing from their home countries because they don't have those protections. We have folks who have been teachers and doctors, orthodontists, who have been able to receive these educations and have not been able to continue with their careers here, but have been filling critical roles. And if there's something the pandemic taught us, was that these immigrant community members were essential to maintain this country, to ensure that construction continued, that critical services such as, you know, trash pickup continued in the city, to ensure that we could all be safe. The nursing industry, the CNA industry, is an industry that is significantly represented by folks of Caribbean descent. So these are just folks like you and me who are just trying to live peaceful lives and trying to be part of the American fabric.
Donald Trump has said he wants to use the U.S. military to assist in these deportation efforts. Jamila, would that be legal? Can the United States military operate on U.S. soil?
So we, legally know that the U.S. military cannot be used to enforce the deportation or used in those means. What we have seen is how Texas has used the National Guard, and we may see states like Texas and other states in which governors, in conjunction or with the support of the president, or influence of the president, try to use the National Guard with different means, especially those states along the border, to try to use them. But something that is really tragic in all of this is that what we've seen in the last couple of years is that recruitment within the military has actually been used. There has been something called military parole in place, which is children of those that are undocumented, that are U.S. citizen, the children of those that are undocumented, that are U.S. citizen. They have decided to join the military to be able to help their parents get legal status. And that has been a recruitment tool that the military has been using to get individuals to join the military. So it would be really tragic to see now that we would be using military members to actually enforce deportation when it was also a recruitment tool that was used to actually get people to join the military.
We're talking about millions of people in this effort to mass deport them, housing them and feeding them while they await processing, transporting them out of the country once they have been told that they cannot stay, would seem to be astronomical. Some estimate the price tag at $86 billion. That in a country where the annual budget for ICE is only $8 billion. And Donald Trump told NBC News that there would be no price tag for his deportation plans, meaning that he's willing to spend whatever it takes. Julian, you're not an economics reporter, but I'm just curious, from all of your poking around on this topic, would wouldn't that require the House of Representatives, since they control the purse strings, to get involved in appropriating money? Would he likely be able to get that money? Do we have any idea where that money would come from? Because he also wants to cut taxes.
Yeah, so definitely the Congress, the House, they would have to approve this spending. And there's a really good report from the American Immigration Council that shows how much it would cost to deport people through this mass deportation plan. 1 million immigrants per year, $88 billion. A one-time operation, close to $1 trillion. So it just goes to show how expensive this plan could be. And a lot of experts don't think it is feasible to deport that many immigrants with that price tag.
Stephanie.
You know, I would just also add that there's a whole other economy, right, that exists as a result of immigration detention. In the U.S., immigration detention is privately run. There are jails that are being administered by private entities that are providing the food, the clothing, the staffing necessary. So one of the things that we've seen, not only under this, right after this presidential election, but in the previous one, was shares being bought for these corporations at high rates, because there is an understanding that money is to be made out of off of people's bodies, right? Off of the detentions of Black and brown people.
Is that a motive?
I would say certainly, right? You know, we know that Trump is, at the end of the day, has moved in ways in where his economic benefit is, and that of his children is a priority for him.
I want to come back to something before we run out of time that is fairly important, I think, in all of this. Trump has also said he wants to end, and this has been brought up in the conversation, birthright citizenship through executive order on day one, to deny citizenship to U.S.-born children of undocumented immigrants. Jamila, you're the lawyer. Can he do that? Isn't birthright citizenship enshrined in the Constitution?
Yes, birthright citizenship is enshrined in the Constitution in the 14th Amendment. It's not to say that he's not going to try. With a lot of what we discussed today, it is not that he's not going to try. It is very likely that day one we will see, much like we saw during the first administration, a slew of executive orders that we will then have to fight it out in the courts. He may very well try to end birthright citizenship, that it will have to reach the Supreme Court, but it is enshrined in the Constitution.
Is he going to use it as a weapon? Because Donald Trump has named Tom Homan to be his border czar. Homan has said, quote, having a U.S. citizen child doesn't make you immune from our laws. If you choose to have a U.S. citizen child while you're in the country illegally, this is a quote, you put yourself in that position. You put your family in that position. So is he going to use this as kind of a cudgel?
I believe so, and I believe it goes back to the fear-mongering. I believe part of it is the rhetoric to fear Americans that their enemy is within, that undocumented citizens are stealing their jobs, are taking things from them, and we all know it's not true. And it's also to fear undocumented immigrants, one, to possibly leave themselves, to self-deport.
And Stephanie Homan led Immigration and Customs Enforcement during the first term of the Trump administration and was an early proponent of separating migrant parents from their children to discourage border crossings. In fact, he has been called the intellectual father of family separation. Some of those children have still not been reunited with their parents. From what you know, are we likely to see that again this time? And how worried are members of the immigrant community about family separation?
It's a great question. You know, it was wildly unpopular when it was done. I think right now we've heard Tom Homan talk about family detention. That is something we have seen in the past under the Obama administration. In Dilley, Texas, for example, whole families were picked up. In Charlotte, also we saw that as well back in January of 2015, families that were being picked up at bus stops when they were taking their children to schools. So we have seen it in the past. He has been an architect of all these policies. And I think Going back to what Jamila said, this is part of his plan to scare folks into thinking about their families and trying to get them to get out while also potentially trying some of these policies as well.
I have only a minute left, and Julian Trump has also threatened to revoke temporary protected status, or TPS, something they tried to do during his first administration for people from certain countries. For whom does that status apply? Who makes the decision who qualifies for it?
Yeah, it people in the administration decide who qualifies for it in the Department of Homeland Security. So there's a lot of countries, Afghanistan, El Salvador, Honduras, places where there is crime, violence, where there's an administration there that is violent, and people have fear of living there.
So the bottom line here, for those who may or may not be impacted by this or may have family members impacted by this, is to know your rights. And one way to do that is to get in touch with the Carolina Migrant Network. They have all sorts of literature for that purpose. Stephanie Arteaga is the co-director there. Jamila Espinosa is an immigration attorney with Espinosa Law. And Julian Berger is race and equity reporter for WFAE News. Thank you all for the hour.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. We have production help from Gene Davis, Chris Jones, and Jesse Steinmetz. For information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.